A general note for clarification, in the following interviews, you may hear those interviewed refer to learning mindsets as academic mindsets. The field around learning mindsets and skills is constantly shifting, and so too is our vocabulary. Recently, the Raikes Foundation conducted extensive research regarding the field and arrived at the title Learning Mindsets and Skills, Empowering Students to Unlock Their Potential. Rest assured that whether those interviewed are referring to academic mindsets or learning mindsets and skills, they are talking about the same thing. Welcome to the Learning Mindsets and Skills Massive Open Online Course Podcast Series. This series is brought to you by the High Tech High Graduate School of Education with support from the Raikes Foundation on the Coursera On Demand MOOC platform. Details about this massive open online course, as well as other courses offered by High Tech High, can be found at www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs. That's www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs. In week one's podcast, we'll be answering the question, what are academic mindsets? Our speaker is no stranger to the subject.
I'm Camille Farrington. I'm a senior research associate at the University of Chicago Consortium on Chicago School Research. I am an education researcher, and I work on understanding kids' experience in school and how that impacts their performance. So I study, I study urban school reform, but through the lens of trying to understand kids' experience in classrooms.
Camille spoke at the closing keynote address at the 2015 Deeper Learning Conference. In order to get to the heart of academic mindsets, Camille first discussed the topic of perceptions and where they originate, as well as how that plays into designing schools.
Or how we design schools and what we do within them. But to start out, first I want to just share a personal story that will, I think, illustrate some of how powerful our perceptions are. So, there we go. Who's my lovely husband? So, we bought some land. We're originally from California, as Nikki said, and we moved to the Midwest in 1993, and we bought this little piece of property up in the Sierras, and over time, we're able to build this cabin on it. But I've been spending, 25 years in this same little area. I know it really, really well. And we have this deck here that looks out. So we're on the side of a mountain, and we have this this deck that looks out over this beautiful kind of mountain range, and goes down to a river. And there's this really interesting, unusual rock formation called the Dardanelles. It's in the Sierras on Highway 4. Maybe you guys know it. And it's this really unusual rock formation, big, huge, thousands of feet tall. And I look at that. I've looked at that same picture for 20-something years. So last summer, I had this very disorienting experience. So a couple friends came. We went for a hike. And so we went up behind our cabin, up to the top of this ridge, went, hiked for a few miles, came back, and I said, instead of coming down the National Forest Road like we normally do, let's cut through the forest and we'll come down, the mountain. And what we're going to do is we're going to come to the top of the mountain that we normally, we're faced here, we normally look at this way, we're going to go up here. And I come around and I look over the top of that mountain. And all of a sudden, I just had this really, what is this vista that I'm looking at? It's this really unusual, it wasn't what I had anticipated was going to be there. It was like this whole bunch of different things were there now, granted, I don't look that way very often. It's up over the top, the backside of the mountain. I don't look that way very often, but I'm just, this is the weirdest thing. I can't figure out, what am I looking at? What am I looking at? And I took a picture of it. This way. I took a picture of it because I wanted to bring it back to my husband and say, what is this thing? What was I looking at? Because I can't picture where I was. And so I come all, we come all the way. And then as we start coming down, I realize I'm com- completely lost. Like, I don't know where I am. I'm wandering this point. And we ended up on this 11-mile hike that we weren't really planning to take because and I was totally disoriented, which I'm really good with directions. And so it was disturbing to me. So then I come back and I show my husband this picture. And I'm like, where were we? And he says, that's the Dardanelles. I mean, it's the thing I look at every single day for 20 years, you know, sitting right outside of our window. And sure damn enough, that is exactly what it is. But, like, I thought I was looking in the north. And so even though I saw the thing that I see every day, I didn't see that that's what it was. Because I was thinking I was looking north. I saw this thing that I knew was in the south, so it never occurred to me that this was the thing I look at every day of my life. And that was, like, profoundly disturbing to me. But it also really hit home, I think, the notion of mindsets. Because we see the world in a particular way, and we impose the way we expect it to be onto what we see. So Carl Weick, who is an organizational psychologist, wrote that reality is an ongoing accomplishment. People make sense of things by seeing a world on which they already imposed what they believe. So I believed I was looking north, and so there was nothing that could make me see what I was really seeing, even though it was right there in front of me.
But where did these academic mindsets come from? Camille also provided historical context.
Mindsets is not a new idea. Academic mindsets might be a new label, but it's not at all a new idea. And there should be below that, you know, a really pretty triangle. So imagine a triangle. Maybe I should just say there really is a triangle there. You just can't see it because you're looking at thinking about something else. So the notion of a hierarchy of needs, Maslow back in 1943, and the idea of where do I belong, can I be successful, and, you know, what can I contribute to this, what can I be good at this, that these are fundamental psychological needs that set up our ability to be motivated to do things. That it is all based upon this. So academic mindsets, nothing new at all about that. If we go back to John Dewey, 1938, great quote from, first of all, you should just, everybody, reread Experience and Education. We've just been revisiting it lately. But this quote, perhaps the greatest of all pedagogical fallacies is the notion that a person learns only the particular thing he is studying at the time. Collateral learning, in the way of formation of enduring attitudes of likes and dislikes, maybe and often is much more important than the spelling lesson or the lesson in geography or history that's learned. For these attitudes are fundamentally what count in the future. The most important attitude that can be formed is that of the desire to go on learning. And so the notion of this is what goes on into the future is because once your mindsets are set, they are set. And they will continue to inform everything you do until something disrupts them.
We sat down one-on-one with Camille, and she provided an in-depth breakdown of the four academic mindsets.
Okay, so there is many decades of work around achievement motivation and also just kind of the psychology of motivation generally. And there are four what we call academic mindsets that are at the heart of learning, and that there's very clear evidence that if kids believe any one of these four beliefs, that they work harder, that they don't give up when they encounter failure or challenges, and they'll kind of work through and complete what they're set out to do, and really gain, learn as a result of that experience. And so the four are, I belong to this academic community or this learning community. My ability and confidence grow with my effort, what Carol Dweck and other people call a growth mindset. This work has value to me, so the idea of relevance. and I can succeed at this, or the idea of self-efficacy. And so, again, for each one of those, there's just clear research evidence that kids who believe these, have these particular attitudes or endorse these beliefs are more perseverant. They engage in the academic behaviors that are important for learning, and they end up doing better academically, performing better academically as a result of that. So what they mean in each one, so if we take them kind of one at a time, so the idea of I belong in this academic community means that you feel it's a place where you are represent, like you can be yourself and you're acknowledged for who you are and what you bring to that space. And it's also the emphasis is I belong to this academic community or this learning community as opposed to just this social community. So there's a lot of kids who come to school because it's a social community, and that's great, and it's really good for them developmentally, but it doesn't necessarily translate into learning in the classroom. So, but if you can create classroom communities where there really is a connection where kids take seriously the learning and help each other to engage in that, and it's something that's valued, people who work hard in this space and really want to learn this, that's something that's socially valued among the kids in the room, then as a participant in that or a member of that community, then membership means learning and achieving. And so that's particularly important because a lot of kids' social identities run counter to that in some kind of way. They get celebrated for things other than that. And so you really have to kind of, as the teacher or the educator, have to figure out how to bridge the gap between acknowledging those other identities and making a space for that in this learning community, but to also then reinforce the idea that membership means being somebody who is somebody who's like deeply engaged in learning. One of the other academic mindsets, the idea of self-efficacy or I can succeed at this, and that is almost always very task-specific. So as you have a particular thing that you're being asked to do in a classroom or in any kind of learning space, that the first thing a learner thinks is like, what is this thing and can I do it? Like, this is one of the first calculations anybody made. What is this thing and do I know how to do it? And if you don't know how to do it, then the question is, do I believe I can do it? And if you make the kind of split second judgment that like, I don't know how to do this and I don't believe I can, then that's kind of the end of it for you. Like you choose, I'm not going to put my energy and invest it in something that I don't think I can be successful in, which makes good sense because we all have like only so much time and energy, and we all, human beings, kind of choose to invest our time and energy in things that we think we can accomplish something with. And so kids are always making these kind of split second judgments about can I succeed in this thing or not. And if we want to create the belief that, yes, I can succeed in that, then certain things have to be in place in the classroom. So one is the student or the learner has to understand what it is, what success would look like. What are you asking me to do? And what kind of performance do I need to do to be successful in this thing? And then what are the steps that, can I see the steps between where I am and where I'm trying to go? Have you laid those out so that I can see them and I can see myself on them? And then what are the supports available for me? And do I believe you that you're going to help me get there? And if I know what the goal is, I see the steps, I trust that you're going to be there with me, you kind of alleviate my fears about this, then I feel like, yes, I can succeed at this. Yes, I will engage in this. Third mindset having to do with the idea of growth mindset, my ability and my competence will grow with my effort, is the flip side of that is a fixed mindset, which is, you know, we only have so much intelligence or we only have so much capacity to understand something or do something. And when we reach the limit of that, there's nothing we can do about it. And if kids feel like they're already at their limit of what they can know, like I can't learn any more math whatever math I know in sixth grade, that's going to be it for me because I can't understand it past this. Then they don't put in, they tend to not, again, to withdraw their effort because they think, what's the point of this? So you want to replace that belief with the idea that your intelligence is, you know, flexible. It's like a muscle that grows with use, and that if you actually put more time and energy and effort into it and kind of struggle with it, you actually will get better at it. And kids who believe that latter thing, again, tend to work much harder at stuff. They, when they run into obstacles, they take those obstacles as thinking like, what do I need to do to get around this? How can I learn better? As opposed to, well, this obstacle clearly is a sign that I've gotten to the edge of what I can do. And so really kind of reinterpreting experience through this growth mindset belief. And then the fourth of the academic mindsets is the idea of relevance, or this work has value to me. And we oftentimes engage kids in schools in work that has value to no one beyond the utility value of the teachers asked me to do this and I have to do it to get the grade. And it turns out that that's a pretty unmotivating, like one of the lowest levels of you know, kind of powerful motivators. Is just doing something because you have to do it, because that you don't understand any reason beyond that. So really trying to find, first of all, give work to kids that's in fact meaningful to somebody beyond the teacher and that is recognized more broadly in the community as important work, then immediately the student can see that there's a meaning and a purpose to what I'm doing beyond just to make you happy, teacher. And there's great, great examples of schools that engage young people in really important work in the world, that where they're contributing to their community, they're contributing more broadly to like the understanding of other people in their classroom as well as kind of outside of their classroom. And that when you take on that kind of real world work, kids are much more likely to just see the value of it and to want to do it well. And so, you know, you work hard at something when it matters that you do it well, and you know that it matters to somebody beyond you and the teacher.
And finally, what about outside factors or disruptive experiences that threaten the process of changing existing mindsets? Camille addressed this at her keynote speech to close out the 2015 Deeper Learning Conference.
Change existing mindsets. So in 2012, my colleagues here at the from the University of Chicago published Teaching Adolescents to Become Learners, and we have this this model of how non-cognitive factors work together to affect school performance, and a big critical part of this is mindsets. That's kind of the driver of this whole thing. And that's because how you perceive the world has everything to do with how much effort you put forth, how you behave, and how well you perform. It all starts with how you see the world.
This podcast and other podcasts like it is available through Libsyn, which allows you to listen to podcasts on iTunes as well as all other podcast dissemination services. To access our library of podcasts, visit www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs and click on the podcast logo. That's www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs and click on the podcast logo.